Welcome to Today on Broadway for Monday, May 22nd, 2017. I'm Broadway World's Matt Tamanini.
And I am Broadway stars James Marino.
James, yesterday Broadway bid farewell to not one but two shows, the original Broadway production of Amelie the Musical and the Sally Field-led revival of Tennessee Williams' The Glass Menagerie. I know you loved one of these productions and were underwhelmed by the other, but we wish the best to the casts, crews, and creative teams and fans of both of these shows. It's just kind of the way things work at this time of the year, especially, James. Some shows find an audience, some don't.
Yes, that's absolutely the truth. And I thought that the Glass Menagerie was going to do much better, especially with Sally Field in it. I really enjoyed this production immensely. And Amelie, I just feel like they need to go back and take another swing at it and think about what they learned from this run, because I think we do have the underpinnings of a good show here. And it was such a wonderful to see Philippa Sue and the rest of the other talented folks on stage there. Just less Elton John, more musical theater. So
so Amelie 2.0 on Broadway in 2018.
Well, 2018, I think they better get back online really quickly. You know, it's like going on your favorite ride at Great Adventure. You got to get off the ride and run back to the end of the line, you know?
All right. 2019, that's okay. Fine. Now, James, you had a really great episode of This Week on Broadway, which came out yesterday. I want to talk a little bit more about this later in this episode, but just let everyone know kind of what you, Michael, and Jan Simpson discussed before we get to it a little bit later on into the script.
Yeah, so Jan Simpson pinched hit for Peter Felicia, who everybody feel bad for him. He got stuck in London seeing some extra shows, and he'll be back with us on This Week on Broadway next week. But he's in London right now, and Michael and Jan did reviews of Pacific Overtures, a classic stage company, a new group's production of The Whirligig, Seven Spots on the Sun at Rattlesnake Playwrights Theater, and the Mint Company's production of The Lucky One. And I'm assuming later on in the Today on Broadway, we're going to talk about what else we talked about.
Yes, that is correct.
All right. First up, Encores announces its 2018 season.
Yeah, on Friday, Arlene Schuller and the New York City Center announced their 2017-2018 season, including the always eagerly anticipated Encores series. Encores' 25th season will kick off with an original production, which is a little unusual for Encores. It will be called Hey, Look Me Over, which will actually showcase songs and scenes from beloved musicals that Encores hasn't gotten to yet, but very well might in the future. Next up in the season will be the beloved Maury Yeston musical Grand Hotel, and if they don't get Tommy Tune to direct, Encores is dead to me. And finally, the season will close with Me and My Girl, the first Encores shows to have originated in the West End, the worst Encore show to have originated in the West End rather than on Broadway. Encores Off-Center will also return next summer, and that season will be announced at a later date. So, James, what do you think of this kind of new out-of-the-box Encores season?
Well, I'm really excited for it. And a bunch of my friends that are diehard, you know, people who work in the industry are really not happy with this season because they feel like it's too commercial, too new, you know, and there are still a lot of things that Encores has stated publicly that they want to do and they haven't done yet insofar as other properties. But I'm thrilled about this. And in fact, we talked a few weeks ago about Grand Hotel and Encores, and I said it in jest, and here it is to happen. So it's just the power of Tamanini.
No, couldn't be further from the truth. But a lot of people are saying that they're hoping that this eventually leads to a Broadway revival of Grand Hotel, because it is one of those shows that many, many, many people just adore and think didn't get the recognition when it originally ran on Broadway. Tommy Tune obviously directed the original Broadway production, which is why I am fully on board with him directing the Encores concert, and then especially because he did an Encores show a year or so ago with Lady Be Good. So he definitely has a relationship with the folks over at City Center. So we'll see what happens. Who knows? Maybe sometime in the, not this coming season, but the season after that, maybe we'll get that full-scale Grand Hotel revival that everybody's been calling for.
One of the funniest posts I saw on Facebook about this was somebody had said, I forget who it was, are they able to carry chairs and scripts at the same time? Which is, you know, kind of an encore joke. They don't carry scripts anymore, but no. It works in the joke.
Yeah, it's funny. That's good.
All right, next up, the Drama League announces its 2017 winners.
Yes, also on Friday. Friday was a big news day for some reason, James. It was a little odd. But on Friday, the Drama League had their annual award ceremony and handed out some trophies over at the Marriott Marquis in Times Square. In the Outstanding Production of a Broadway or Off-Broadway Play category, Oslo was the winner. For Outstanding Revival of a Broadway or Off-Broadway Play, the winner was Jitney. Outstanding Production of a Broadway or Off-Broadway Musical went to Dear Evan Hansen. And Outstanding Revival of a Broadway or Off-Broadway Musical was Hello, Dolly. As a reminder, the Drama League nominates literally about 50 people every year for the Distinguished Performance Award, both male and female, and actors can win only once in their lifetime. So this year's Distinguished Performance Award went to Dear Evan Hansen's Ben Platt. James, I don't know that anyone is too shocked about any of those things, and I don't know about you, but I think these very well might be predictors about what we will see at the Tony Awards here in a few weeks.
Yeah, I think that these are tracking pretty well with what I would guess are going to be the winners. I have no qualms with any of that. All right. Next up, Come From Away announces a national tour.
Yeah, again, on Friday, the Broadway production of Come From Away announced that tickets would go on sale. Actually, it happened when the announcement came out. So last Friday, tickets went on sale for the Broadway production through May of 2018. So while that doesn't guarantee that the show will still be running by then, it does mean that they kind of feel good about it running for another year. But they also announced that a national tour of the show would launch from Seattle's Fifth Avenue Theater in October of 2018. This news comes in addition to the previously announced Toronto sit-down production, which will begin in February of 2018 as well. James, it's not Hamilton by any means, where they're thinking about having like 117 different productions going worldwide, but it is cool to see this little show, which literally has next to no pedigree, come out of nowhere and have so much success. It's got all these Tony nominations, all these other award wins, and it's going to have three worldwide productions potentially going on at the same time in 2018.
Well, you know, this show, Come From Away, has a few things really going for it. Aside from being a really interesting property that's unique, and it's good, and it's appealing to audiences commercially, and it's produced in a way that, in my eyes, is very smartly produced in a way to make money, in the ways in which they double the casts and the way that the sets can travel really well and things like that. So I think that it's firing on all cylinders, and I think these tours are going to be a success, because not only can they play the large houses like the Fox in Atlanta, but they can play small houses around the nation as well.
Yeah, and that's evidenced by the fact that it's launching at the Fifth Avenue, which is not something like the Fox, like you've mentioned, which I've been to many times. It's a smaller, more of a regional theater where they do have some tours come through there. But generally, when I think of the Fifth Avenue Theater in Seattle, I think of that's where a lot of shows do out-of-town tryouts. So it's not this huge, grand, 3,000-seat theater. It's more of a smaller, more intimate house. So it's cool that we're seeing it play in probably all different kinds of theaters. And like you said, the design and the way the show is produced probably makes that, feasible for all types of places across North America and potentially the world.
Yeah. And talking about the development of new musicals, we have some information on the workshop lab and readings.
Yeah, James, it kind of feels like right now we're in the middle of the New York version of pilot season, mm-hmm. as we are getting a bunch of news about readings and labs and workshops and all of the different incarnations about how a show gets made. So I just wanted to briefly run through some of those things that were reported late last week here. First is that Alex Weiss, Lindsay Mendez, and Queen Leslie Margarita, along with Saikhan Singhblah and more, will lead a private first act developmental reading of a new musical adaptation of The Talented Mr. Ripley tomorrow and Wednesday. Wednesday. The musical will feature a book and lyrics by Gregory Bonsignore and music by Aaron Kenny. It is based on the incredibly trippy 1955 novel and 1999 movie of the same name. Also of note, today, former 98 Degrees member, Rent star, and Dancing with the Stars champion Drew Lachey will lead a reading of a new musical called Bulldozer. The musical has a book by Peter Galperin and Scott Caden, and Galperin wrote the score. Bulldozer tells the story of Robert Moses, a man who literally shaped New York through his control of its park system, streets, bridges, and tunnels. I guess that's where the name Bulldozer comes in. And finally, choreographer Chris Catelli has officially signed on to work on the October Lab of what is now officially being called The Cher Show. And Jason Moore is directing, as he did the previous incarnation that we've talked about before. And Rick Ellis has written the book, and it'll feature three phases of Cher's life and career and will make use of her incredible catalog of pop hits. As we've discussed, the show is broken into those three parts of Cher's life. The first, called Babe, starts with her falling in love with Sonny Bono. The second, called Lady, follows her as she navigates the entertainment industry. And finally, Star, which shows what she became or how she became the person that we know now. In the earlier reading that was in January of this year, the three different Chers, because there's a different actress playing Cher at each part in her life, they were played by Jillian Mueller, Lena Hall, and Leslie Margarita. I actually spoke with Leslie Margarita yesterday, and she's been in like 107 workshops this spring, it seems like. So eventually I think we'll get her back on Broadway, because at some point the law of large numbers dictates that one of these shows is going to make it to Broadway.
Yes, that's true. That's exciting. And I hope that we get to see these shows pretty soon. Next up, Universal sets a release date for... No.
Yes. Really? Yes. Go ahead and say it.
A sequel of the Mamma Mia film.
Yes, I guess the way I said it was in news that I guess someone maybe somewhere wanted. On Friday, Universal announced that Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again, yes, that is the subtitle, will be released on July 20th of 2018.
Now, what is... Wait. Go ahead. Isn't Friday afternoon the time that we dump all these press releases of things we don't really care about?
Normally that's true, but we seem to have been getting a lot of big news on Friday, so I don't know that this falls in the same category as like...
I could see Friday morning, but Friday afternoon, Friday evening for a film release? It's Mamma Mia. It's going to come back, man.
Yeah.
Are they going to make it into a stage show?
Who knows? Well, I know, but here's what I do think is interesting about this, James. They don't really know what... I don't think they have a script written yet. And the reason I say that is because what they mention is that the film might actually be a prequel, looking at the early relationship between Donna and Sam and Donna and Harry. James, I feel like this is a safe place, so I feel comfortable in confessing that I've never seen Mamma Mia on either stage or screen, so I have no idea if this prequel decades before the original actually holds water or not. But I think if they do this new film without Streep and, more importantly, Baranski, I think it's a huge mistake and a missed opportunity.
I wonder if they will go back to do it after all of the abuse that they took during the first one, and you've not seen it on stage or screen. No. I would stick to the ABBA recordings and think of yourself.
That's why I never saw it. That's why I never saw it on stage or screen. It's because it has ABBA music.
Oh, I see. You're not an ABBA fan. And, you know, I think of yourself as not having taken either the blue or the red pill.
Again, Venn diagram of Mamma Mia and Matrix fans.
Not a big overlap there. All right. What's up in the reading recommendations?
Okay, James, again, like I said, a ton of stuff came out on Friday, and there's a ton of things that really interested me over the weekend. So I wanted to go through as many of them as possible. I broke them down into a reading recommendations and a video recommendation section, mainly because I feel like for each of these reading recommendations, we could probably do like a whole 20-minute segment on each of them, which you might have done. So we'll talk about that one in a minute. But first, James, you'll remember last week we discussed Glenn Close's letter of apology that she sent out after having missed the Mother's Day performance of Sunset Boulevard. At the time, there was just something about it that made me uncomfortable. And while I think my reticence was about the inherent, if not unintended, denigration of understudies, the great and the good Cynthia Erivo chimed in as well. On Facebook, she said, quote, "It is unnecessary for her to apologize for being ill. The fact that people have decided that not apologizing for being ill is not classy annoys the heck out of me. 2 exclamation points. When you are ill, the only thing you should be required to do is get well. Which other profession requires a statement of apology for being incapacitated? 3 question marks. None. 3 exclamation points. And I'm throwing in the punctuation to show you that Cynthia Erivo ain't messing around, and she's not someone I would want to cross when she's not messing around. That was part of dozens and dozens of responses on Facebook. And while I don't know that it led to any definitive should an actor apologize for missing a performance or not position, I was glad that someone of Erivo's stature chimed in.
Well, I totally agree with what she has said there. But in this world where people are paying hundreds, if not thousands of dollars for tickets, I don't think that Glenn Close was required to. I thought it was really, you know, a nice thing for her to do. I don't think she was required to. I don't expect people to do that. And you know what? You tell me, Matt Tamanini, you know, when a star quarterback or ball player or something like that misses a big game, you know, it's big news.
It is, actually. You know, what's interesting about it is it actually correlates pretty well to an issue that's going on in the NBA right now. I won't bore, you know, our listeners with this a whole lot, but over the last season or two, started by Greg Popovich, who's the head coach, the longtime head coach of the San Antonio Spurs, world champion multiple times, he started sitting out his star players at random times throughout the years, usually when they're on the road and usually against big opponents, both for strategic purposes and for rest purposes. And this is become a trend with some of the bigger stars in the NBA, and it has led to a lot of fans and media members complaining that the teams and the stars were doing a disservice to their fans. Now, it's a little different with Broadway. Obviously, this is not apples to apples, but it is interesting that it does seem to have a correlation between this issue with the star of Glenn Close's stature with someone like LeBron James, who has, you know, taken a few games off here and there, upset some visiting fans, but is now going on to have the best postseason of his entire career and to establish himself even further in the discussion of being the greatest basketball player of all time.
All right. So let's move forward into the...
Nothing. Just don't know.
Well, you know, I just see that we have a ton of stuff in front of us.
Yes. You're right.
Theater casting directors fight to unionize.
Yeah, yesterday, Ginger Adams Otis of the New York Daily News wrote a story about the efforts of Broadway casting directors and their attempts to unionize. The article goes into why the biggest names in castings, think Tara Rubin, Bernie Telsey, think why this is important and an instrumental not only for them but for future generations of casting directors. She also discusses why the Broadway League is refusing to recognize their unionizing efforts, and she discusses the fact that there's only 40 casting directors working on Broadway, which I understand that there's only about 40 new shows on Broadway every year. I think there were 38 or 39 this past season, but that number seems really small to me. I just assume that, like, you know, there's one head casting director, then like 3 or 4 on each show, and I know they overlap, but that was a small number. Anyway, James, it sounds to me like this story is going to be around for a while, so I think we'll be hearing more about it, especially since the league has said that they are willing to expedite a National Labor Relations Board process, basically contesting it. They're saying these are people who have separate businesses. They're independent contractors, so it's not the same as actually being an employee of a Broadway show, which is kind of where their logistical difference comes in. But it'll be interesting. And, you know, especially since literally every other job on Broadway is unionized, from ushers to ticket takers to stagehands to directors to choreographers to actors and everything in between, pretty much everybody except casting directors.
I hadn't realized that. I guess I did know that the casting directors were not unionized, and it seems like just do it. I don't know the big issues surrounding this. Certainly, if the producers are pushing back on it, it has to be a cost reason, that there must be pension, health, and welfare that casting directors are looking to get paid for. I don't know anything about this specific issue, but let's stay on top of this. Next up, yep. Louis, is it Peitzman? Peetzman?
Yes. Peetzman. I actually talked with our friend Patrick Hines to make sure I got the pronunciation correctly, and he sent me a voice text with the pronunciation to make sure I didn't screw it up. So, yes, Peetzman.
So Lewis Peetzman of on the Virginia Woolf casting debate, Lewis writes for BuzzFeed.
Correct. James, finally in this reading recommendation section, I wanted to point out Lewis Peetzman's article at BuzzFeed that goes in depth and presents really a more nuanced look at the casting controversy over the Oregon production of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf that I mentioned on Friday's show. Lewis does a great job of mapping out all of the issues at play. But James, I want people to read that. It'll be in the show notes. But James, the reason I bring this up, as we mentioned at the top of the show, I know that you, Jan, and Michael also discussed this very thing fairly in depth and very intelligently on This Week on Broadway.
Yeah. So we had about a 20 some odd minute discussion about the issues surrounding Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf and the and a production's attempt to cast a black man in a role that is written for a white person who is a blonde, blue-eyed Nazi sympathizer or an actual Nazi. And the estate of Albee would not grant the Oregon production the rights to do this production. So it kind of got all stopped up there, which is the whole story. But we had really a good 360 view on all the issues there, and I encourage people to listen to This Week on Broadway to catch up on all the great things that Michael and Jan said about it.
Yeah, I think it's especially interesting, one that you had Jan on because she is a woman of color, but also because her day job is in academia. So I think it's really interesting that you had her perspective on there so that she can kind of give the perspective of you know, a woman of color, but also from a kind of an academic standpoint. I think that's probably different than Peter or Michael would have, because they're coming at from more of the inside the theater specifically, while Jan is obviously as much of an insider as she is, but she also has kind of a different perspective. So I think that's really interesting to get that insight in the discussion.
All right. Next up, the video recommendations.
Yeah, I'm not going to belabor many of these. I'm just going to mention them real quickly. On Friday, PBS released a sneak peek of their upcoming Live from Lincoln Center presentation of the Falsettos revival. It was very, very cool. I've never seen Falsettos, don't know the score very well, but I loved this preview. Still no air date for when this will come up on PBS, but check that out. We'll have it in the show notes. Then yesterday at the Vulture Fest in New York City, there was a ton of really cool pop culture things going on. One thing I wanted to mention, Titus Burgess had his own session. It was called Titus Burgess Pinot Noir and a Grand Piano. If you watch Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, you know where the Pinot Noir thing comes in. But he's saying a bunch of things. He's saying King of the World from Songs for a New World, some other time from On the Town, and then saying Get Happy with his Netflix co-star Jane Krakowski. But one of the things that made me super happy, because he played Sebastian in the Broadway production of Little Mermaid, he's saying Poor Unfortunate Souls. And I guess it was kind of throwing his name in the ring to sing the Ursula part in Little Mermaid Live, whatever that thing is going to be in October on ABC. And then finally, James, I've been waiting for it. We've talked about it. It is finally here. From Theater Mania, Laura Benanti explains the 2016-2017 plays. I'm assuming that the musicals version will come in sometime this week or in the next week or so. Laura Benanti with a baby that she admits at the end is not actually her baby. I'm sure it's actually a dummy or prop or whatever. She goes through all of the plays from this past season. She knows absolutely nothing about any of them, but for the last 4 years, this has been one of the highlights of Tony season, and I absolutely love it. I love Laura Benanti. I've made no secret of that. And so this made me happy.
What's the name of the Broadway baby doll that they bring up on all the different in all
Tam,
the different
yeah, Tam something or other with Jen Cody and Bryn O'Malley and all those people pass it around and stuff. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I wonder if if they use that.
Very well. Could be.
All right. Well, you know, get your detective hat on and check that out. We'll bring it back to you tomorrow if we hear anything about that. Why don't you get us out of here?
All right. Thanks for listening to Today on Broadway. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Broadway Radio, and you can find me on Twitter at BWWMatt, and subscribe to Something Like a Pop on iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play.
And my name is James Marino from BroadwayRadio.com and BroadwayStars.com. Thanks for starting off your week with us, and we'll be back and talk with you tomorrow.